You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. Moving on, we're going to head to sunny California, and we're going to be talking about the Bayside Covenant Church. Now, they disclosed that they were just victim of a phishing attack that gained access to information on their parishioners and other sensitive data, etc. And this basically, this breach occurred between August 3rd and October 20th of 2018. So if you are affiliated with the Bayside Covenant Church in California, and I have no idea how big that church is, I know some churches are utterly massive with locations around the globe, and I don't know if this is one of them, heads up on that. Moving on, we're going to be heading towards scenic Lake Winnipesaukee, and there is a real estate developer called Aqua Vista. Now, they have recently disclosed in the last week or two that they fell victim to a phishing campaign. And can you see the similarities here? So many companies fall for phishing campaigns. It's utterly ridiculous. That basically between May 11th and August 31st of last year, thanks to a phishing campaign, hackers had access to very sensitive data for Aqua Vista. So if you are affiliated with that real estate developer, heads up on that. Moving on, we're going to be talking about the Valley Hope Association. Now, they are a nonprofit addiction clinic based out of Kansas, and they have 16 facilities, I believe, in multiple states. They got hit by a phishing attack, big surprise, and they got a phishing attack in November, but they actually discovered that in they got hit in October, but discovered that in November. And so by virtue of a HIPAA compliance breach, they are now disclosing that as well. So if you are associated with the Valley Hope Association, heads up. Now let's move on to Australia. Now, Australia's parliament, their government, actually about a month ago or so, and I did a video on this, basically said that their network has been hacked. Now, they came out, both wings of the parliament came out in a joint statement saying that no voting, you know, on the floor had been, tampered with, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But interestingly enough, as I'm sitting here talking to you, about 12 hours before I'm literally, you know, talking to you here about this, new articles are coming out saying that due to forensic analysis and investigation, it looks like a state-sponsored hacking attempt is what happened here. And so while Australia is saying they didn't get that deep and they didn't, you know, steal information or change vote totals or anything like that, they are now saying that this is a state-sponsored actor. This is actually an unfolding data breach as we are sitting here talking about this. And as this comes up, probably in my next show, I'm going to be updating you on this because it's state-sponsored hacking. It involves literally a massive government and it is a serious problem. So I will definitely let you know, you know, about that. And on and on. Like I said, this is probably the longest breaches of the week I've ever had. We're heading back to the UK and to Suffolk County. Now, this is a very localized data breach in the sense that a couple adopted three children, I'm guessing from a local orphanage or a county facility or whatever, but the county accidentally gave their information, meaning names, addresses, etc., to the birth mother. And it is being reported that this couple said, well, you know, we are very afraid that the birth mother, who had her children taken away for whatever reason, is going to come after these kids. She's going to want her kids back, or maybe she's got relatives. And they have done things like, you know, put in closed circuit television and advanced security measures, you know, for physical security in their home. And the county has apologized and offered them monetary compensation, but they're obviously saying that's not enough because they've got a lot of fear and anxiety when they were supposed to be adopting three kids to hopefully have a family together. So that is very depressing. But Suffolk County, I hope you guys make that right. Moving on to South Africa, one of the largest electricity utility companies out there is a company called Eskom. Now, it's interesting is that an ethical hacker actually found that Eskom's was essentially leaking data, that he could go in and access sensitive data that he shouldn't be able to. He apparently, according to all reports, contacted Eskom multiple times saying, hey guys, you have a leak, you have an exposure, you need to plug this, etc. And essentially nothing happened, no responses, didn't do anything about it. And so he said, okay, well, I've done my due diligence. Now it's time to report the media, and report he did. South Africa media kind of blew up saying, hey, you know, we have this serious problem with this utility company, and hopefully now Eskom is getting off their collective utility butts and fixing this issue. And so hopefully if you're in South Africa, your data was not exposed, especially if you're an Eskom customer. Moving on, we're going to be talking about Cal Poly University. Similar to Stanford, they just had a data breach, and it's in the College of Science. And it was when an Excel file of just over 4,500 students was accidentally sent out to a third party that should not have had that information. Again, this is information that would be that could be used to have basically run an identity theft on any one of these 4,500 to 5,000 students. And so that's a serious problem. And if you are with Cal Poly, heads up on that. Moving on, we're going to be talking about the State Bank of India. Now, news outlets in India have been reporting that there is a serious data leak for literally millions of customers for the State Bank of India, exposing their personal and sensitive information out on, you know, online into the dark web. Now, what's interesting about this is that the State Bank of India has come out and basically 100% denied this. There is no breach. We don't have a problem. We don't know what people are talking about. And so, is the media basically in India picking up on rumor and speculation, or, you know, unwarranted, is creating unwarranted accusations based on false evidence, or is the State Bank of India essentially lying and trying to cover themselves? And I think time will tell. We will see if information that gets tied back to State Bank of India starts showing up on the dark web or other outlets, then we're going to know that the State Bank of India was essentially just trying to cover themselves and the media was correct. Or if nothing comes to fruition, maybe State Bank is absolutely right. We'll see. The next one we're gonna be talking about is moves us back into Australia, and this is actually a massive problem. On top of the whole Parliament hacking the government with a state-sponsored issue, we have another thing that might potentially damage the economic stability of Australia. And for my Australian listeners, and I do have a pretty sizable contingent in Melbourne, Brisbane, and Sydney. Guys, heads up on this. You probably know about this in your news media, but if you don't, pretty much every bank in Australia, especially the major ones, use a company called Landmark White. Now, what this company does is it runs valuations for the banks. Landmark White got hit. And so basically the media and the banks are saying this is an industry-wide issue. You can't point to like the National Australia Bank or any one of the other big banks in Australia to say it's their fault, because they're all using Landmark White and therefore they all have this data exposure. And by virtue of this, it's a serious problem. Now, this actually flew under the radar for weeks, from what I understand. Like, it was reported, but, you know, it really didn't pick up until, I guess, one of the major news outlets discovered it in the beginning of February and actually started talking about this. And that is obviously a serious, serious problem. And so if you're in Australia, odds are your bank is affected. I hope you are not. Moving on with that, we're going to talk about something that might even be more serious than all of the cybersecurity trouble that Australia is having at the moment, and that's a company called ImageEye Nation Technologies. And if you're thinking, how could this possibly rival an entire country having issues with, you know, their banks and their government, here's why. ImageEye Nation Technologies actually provides hosting and software for consumer reporting agencies like Equifax, TransUnion, Experian, and on and on and on. They just declared they had a supply chain breach and hackers had unauthorized access and gained pretty much info on anyone that had a consumer report run, through their systems, through their infrastructure. They got personal information, including first and last names, date of birth, address, social security numbers, etc. Pretty much anything, to run a scam. And why this is a serious problem is that if you remember back in the day, we had the Equifax breach, which was utterly massive, that pretty much affected every man, woman, and child in the United States, even though Equifax completely lied on the depth and scope of that on those numbers. And they have been raising that number slowly over the years as, you know, now they're flying under the radar. The dust has settled off of that blast. But ImageEye literally has hosting infrastructure for Equifax and Equifax's major competitors, TransUnion and Experian. That potentially means that we don't just have an Equifax breach, we might have an Equifax times three data breach on here, and it is flying under the radar right now. Very few people are reporting on this. I have been looking for more information on this, and I just am been baffled because, I mean, maybe we have data breach fatigue. I'm not sure, but this is a serious, serious problem that could potentially just absolutely explode, because it's not just the United States. Multiple countries around the world use these consumer reporting bureaus. They're massive. So we'll see where that goes, but that has the potential to absolutely dwarf, you know, the serious, serious problems we're seeing in Australia right now. And finally, on a lighter note, we're going to talk about a very localized and personal data breach, and that would be Jeff Bezos. Now, it's very possible his very special quote-unquote Amazon package may be delivered to the public via the National Enquirer and all of that, and I typically don't keep up with these tabloids, but when I read about this, issue, I thought to myself, well, how did they gain access to the data? I mean, being in cybersecurity and a hacker myself, I want to know these things. And it would appear that a family member of, I guess, his mistress, I don't know now, girlfriend, whatever she is, gained access to the data off of her phone and then either sold it or gave it to another party. And I'll leave it at that. I just thought that was kind of amusing, you know, in the sense that, you know, a data breach of one can be, you know, a very serious issue, especially when you're worth something like $150 billion, which is absolutely insane. So here we are. Those are your data breaches of the week. I think this was as long as the deep dive segment, if not a little longer, but we seem to be increasing more and more into this territory of just larger and larger data breaches and more complex. So I will, as always, keep you up to date here. And thank you for listening to me, you know, on Data Breaches of the Week. And we'll keep on going. You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And now for the Deep Dive segment, where we take a closer and deeper look at a cybersecurity, cyber warfare, or technology issue around us. And if you have any suggestions for a Deep Dive segment or something you'd like me to dive into, you can once again find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. That's questions@securityfanatics.com. I am more than happy to take a look at it. And if it meets our standards, we are more than happy to do a deep dive on it. So let's begin. And this deep dive is slightly a revisit from a previous deep dive. Now, I've done DNA and privacy on the radio show before, but we've had significant updates in this that, quite frankly, we didn't see coming necessarily, or if we did, it was flying under the radar and it pretty much escaped everybody's grasp. But we have some serious problems going on. So with that, I'd like to start. And we're gonna be talking first about CODIS. That's CODIS. If you're not familiar with this, this is actually a national database that federal law enforcement like the FBI uses to essentially track criminals. So, for example, let's say the FBI gets called into a serial killer. They're going to take, let's say, possible suspect DNA. They're going to upload it into CODIS, and then they're going to try to get a match on that individual, or at least store that as they then gather suspects and compare it against the DNA at the scene of the crime, etc. Now, this process for CODIS actually has taken a couple of weeks. So let's say they get a suspect's DNA, they go ahead and they upload it to CODIS, and about 2-3 weeks later or so, they get results. This has been considered essentially too slow. What if you are tracking a serial killer and you think you've got the suspect, but it's going to take you 2 weeks to verify the DNA, and what do you do? Let that person go to kill again, etc. So this was the impetus for what was the Rapid DNA Act. Now, this was signed into law by President Trump in 2017. And basically, this is what it does. It allows the FBI, the federal law enforcement, to basically run DNA results and get them back from CODIS in less than 90 minutes. And so that is an obvious benefit to law enforcement in the sense that, well, if they have a suspect, here we go. We can in 90 minutes know, and that obviously, definitely helps them. This was actually passed by a bipartisan Congress. And so U.S. Congress, Democrats and Republicans voted for this. In the Senate, Democrats and Republicans voted for this as well. And so this was essentially unanimous on both sides that, yes, we are all for this. But here's the thing. The legislation also asks the Federal Bureau of Investigation to issue standards and procedures for use of rapid DNA technology so the fully automated process can be used virtually anywhere. Any criminal justice agency across the United States can collect swabs, upload them to upload the DNA samples to CODIS, and then get results on that. And so instead of being a federal database, what you have is a ton of local law enforcement being able to collect information on you, upload it to the database, and then get results on you, or compare it, you know, to other results that they have. And so what this has basically turned CODIS into is a national DNA database registry. And some people have issues with this. So if we are looking at groups like the Innocence Project or the Rutherford Institute, which is a civil liberties, basically they're like an ACLU, they have some problems with this. And reports have mentioned that this means the police can routinely take DNA samples from people who are arrested from a crime, but not yet convicted of a crime. And that's a serious problem for the Innocence Project, as well as the Rutherford Institute. Now, John Whitehead from the Rutherford Institute took it one step further, and I'm going to quote him here because I think he sums up their position rather nicely. And I quote, "We could look at a situation in which somebody could be arrested, have their mouth swabbed, and then be charged within hours after generating a DNA profile. We are looking at the erosion of the concept of innocent before proven guilty because it will allow police to go on fishing expeditions. When you sit on a park bench, you shed DNA. This is now up for grabs by police who could swab it and run it through a DNA database. If they find a match or if misconduct occurred anywhere in the vicinity where your DNA was found, you might find yourself charged with a crime you never committed merely because you happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Even people who aren't charged with major crimes could have their DNA put on file. People who are just seen as suspicious could have their genetic makeup stored in a criminal database. And we're also giving our and we're also giving out that information, you know, to third parties as well. And so that is a big problem, you know, that we have. And so let's say I'm, you know, I live in an urban area. I spend a lot of time in downtown Chicago, which means if I'm, let's say, at a restaurant with my family, or I'm visiting clients or a museum, or, you know, just going to the park, you know, whatever I'm doing, I'm leaving DNA places. And if a crime happens to occur, which, okay, it's Chicago, so we know that's going to happen. What if my DNA is one of those things that is in there, you know, that is in the vicinity, that is swabbed, and now I am a suspect because I have been there? You know, that's a major problem. And on top of all of this, now having local law enforcement basically creating this DNA database, on top of it, we have millions of Americans that have been routinely giving away their DNA to groups like 23andMe, MyHeritage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And before I dive into some of those, we know that if we have 2%, a DNA profile on exactly 2% of the global population, we have a DNA profile on the entire population of the planet. The reason being is that we're all genetically related. I mean, going back far enough, half of you listening here are probably, we probably have some kind of cousin, you know, in relation to each other. And if we go back far enough, all of us do. And so when we're looking at this, you know, we can find people and narrow people down, you know, through their cousins, through their relatives. And one of those ones is the Golden State Killer. Now, if you recall, in 2000, I believe it was 18, might have been 17, the police basically decided to run the cold case of the Golden State Killer and take DNA samples that were collected at the crime scene and run them through a public database. This is a research database that many people have willingly uploaded their database, their DNA information to, and they got a hit. They didn't find the Golden State Killer. They found relatives of the Golden State Killer, which then narrowed the suspect list down to exactly that person. They caught him, obviously, by virtue of that, and were able to convict him, you know, of that crime, you know, several years later. And so we see the power that DNA has through, you know, through our relatives. And so you don't have to sit for a DNA test, but if you've got a cousin out there, or a sibling, or a mother, or a father, or aunt, uncle, you know, second cousin, etc., they're now narrowing down the suspect pool simply because of that. And so privacy is a very difficult thing when we're talking about DNA. And on top of that, as we are willingly giving away our DNA to third-party companies, as millions have done to 23andMe, Family Tree DNA, MyHeritage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we start to see problems crop up. And it's in part law enforcement, in part cybersecurity, in part major corporations. And as we go through this, I mean, let's take a look at the list. So 23andMe partnered up with one of their major investors, which happened to be GlaxoSmithKline, that essentially invested hundreds of millions of dollars into 23andMe, and they are now taking the DNA profile submitted to 23andMe for advanced genetic research. Now, that's obviously in some aspects a good thing. If they're able to, let's say, find a cure for cancer, nobody's really complaining about that. But how they handle that data, how they treat that data, you know, which is essentially 100% unique and personal to anybody that has submitted DNA information to 23andMe, that's a serious problem. We also learned about Family Tree DNA on February 4th of this year. It was publicly understood, and they apologized for this, that they were sharing DNA with the FBI because the FBI was looking for murderers, violent criminals, all this kind of stuff. And so they would give a DNA profile and say, oh, are you Bob Smith? Bob Smith. Here's Bob Smith, and here's Bob Smith's DNA. FBI, have at it. Take a look. And so from the New York Times, the article that essentially broke this, I quote, unbeknownst to its users, the Houston-based firm quietly and voluntarily agreed in 2018 to open its database of more than 2 million records to the FBI and examine DNA samples in its laboratory to identify suspects and victims of unsolved rapes and murders. And so while that may, let's say, be a noble cause, I mean, I think every murderer and rapist should be caught, what else does this open it up to? And, you know, maybe you're not. Maybe you have some DNA profile and it's not you. It's a cousin. It's a relative. I mean, we have a lot of different issues with this. And when we're looking at this, one of the other things that we're looking at is, you know, how do we lock this down? At the end of the day, we have, let's say, a massive federal law enforcement that now includes local law enforcement DNA database called CODIS. We've got 23andMe. We've got Family Tree DNA. We've got MyHeritage DNA, which essentially was a massive cybersecurity breach, and over 90 million records from MyHeritage DNA were stolen by hackers, and dumped onto the dark web. And so we are trusting these organizations. We're also trusting law enforcement, whether it's with our cybersecurity that they're going to maintain good standards, whether it's with our privacy rights that they are, you know, only going to use the DNA for good and not actually catalog the DNA, et cetera, which is a serious concern for groups like the Innocent Project, the Rutherford Institute, and privacy advocates everywhere. But we are sitting on this, and there seems to be no recourse. So I will give you a perfect example, like of myself. I have not taken a DNA test. I have not gone to 23andMe, et cetera, and, you know, submitted DNA to that. I have also not been a suspect, as far as I know, you know, in some kind of federal, state, or local crime. And so I've never had my DNA taken, by any kind of law enforcement. And so I don't know if any of my relatives have. I might have a cousin out there, you know, that has done that, that has submitted those samples to one of these companies. And by virtue of that, I am now, at least in part, in a database identified by who I am related to. And so if I want total privacy from these third-party corporations, as well as, let's say, my government, I now really don't have that ability because my relatives, who, let's say, have a different view on this or simply just didn't understand the ramifications and implications of this, decided, well, I'm going to do this. I'd like to learn who my, you know, far distant relatives are, et cetera, and here we go. And so what does that look like? What does the future look like when we are talking about DNA privacy in the future? You know, we need to understand, how we can either combat this, secure this, make this private, et cetera. And right now there are essentially two schools of thought on this. First, we legislate through government a very stringent DNA privacy law, something like what the GDPR is in Europe. And if you're not familiar with the GDPR, and I know I've mentioned it here on the air before, it's essentially this. The GDPR is a general data protection rule for consumers and citizens of the European Union against companies like Facebook, Google, and others that data mine them. As an EU citizen, you have the right to go to, let's say, Facebook, for example, and say, I want to know everything you have on me. you know, what data do you have on me? How have you used it? Who have you sold it to? And I want you to formally and completely erase me from this, or allow or block, you know, whatever advertising they want to do to you. That was a major shift for privacy rights in the European Union, and we don't have anything like that here in the United States. And so if we were to legislate something like that, that would give us the ability to go to a 23andMe, a MyHeritage, the FBI, whatever, and say, what DNA do you have on me? What are you doing with it? How has it been used? And I want my DNA erased permanently from any of these databases. That obviously becomes a significant problem and an issue, especially when you have cousins involved, because let's say your cousin doesn't want his or her, you know, data erased because they simply don't care or don't understand, or, you know, whatever their logic or reasoning is, you know, and that's fine. And we can look at examples of where we open up cans of worms in this. So I did audio on my daily podcast and video on my daily videos of a woman that had a 5-year-old daughter that she had conceived through a donation from a sperm bank. And so when her daughter was 5, she put her daughter's DNA up on 23andMe. And the goal there was not to find relatives. The goal was to say, okay, I want to understand what my daughter may be susceptible future in life. Does she have a possible problem with cancer or dementia, et cetera, et cetera. But 23andMe, being kind of social networking on top of this, as they all are, these third-party companies, linked her to the sperm donor, linked her to the father, the actual biological father, who obviously wants nothing to do, you know, with this child, because again, he's a sperm donor. And so she basically reached out, and then she got slapped down by the adoption agency saying, you can't do that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so how do we legislate that? And thank you so much for tuning in this week. It was another fun show, and I think we covered a lot of really good stuff, and I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. It was a really good time, and I hope you keep tuning in. Thank you very much for listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show here with Nick Espinoza. And if you have any comments, suggestions, questions, absolutely anything, once again, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. And you can always send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. Don't be shy. I love the feedback. We've been having a great time with the show. And as always, stay safe and stay online, everyone. Thanks for listening.